Next Chapter Podcasts.
Hi, and welcome back to How I Got Greenlit, where we continue our conversation with mega producer Evan Ostrowski as he talks about the making of Cabin Fever and many of his other great films, and discusses the influence of the classic film Manhunter from director Michael Mann. Without further ado, this is part two of our interview with Evan Ostrowski on How I Got Greenlit.
I would be remiss, Evan, and I don't know if this is the proper time, because I don't, even though we've been friends for a while, I personally don't know the timeline. But I think something that people should know about you, and that you're proud of in a way, is that you suffered a catastrophic injury at some point in time. And I think it's important we talk about that. Do you want to talk about that?
Sure. I mean, you know, I'm very open about it. I broke my neck when I was 25. This was 1996. So before I made my first film, I was working in New York, working in advertising, working at just working. And I broke my neck on the beach. A wave flipped me around and put me in a wheelchair for a year. And I walk with canes. I walk with leg braces. I have a spinal cord injury. I will have one for all my days here on this earth. It's probably in a way affecting me in ways that it's difficult for me to process or to really know. But, you know, when I was younger, making Cabin Fever, making Dead in the Water, it wasn't that so much of a big deal. I walked with like a limp and a cane and blah, blah, blah. That just was part of my shtick. And, you know, now as I age, it's a little more challenging for me to go places, but yeah, that's part of my story.
But what people, and this is something Alex and I have gotten from other guests, the process of making movies, making films, is a long...
It's emotionally handicapping.
It's emotionally handicapping, but it's a physically hard process every day. And you have, you know, you're there on your feet all day. And You got bounced off the bottom of the reef.
My head hit the bottom of the ocean, snapped my neck at the C5 vertebrae, which is, you know, right by your Adam's apple, if you have an Adam's apple, and everything from my chest down stopped working instantly. My girlfriend at the time, is now my wife, Anna, pulled me out, saved me from dying.
You were dying.
I was drowning. I was unconscious and drowning.
She pulled you to shore, right?
Pulled me to shore with the help of, you know, and then she got me ashore, and the lifeguards were really Johnny on the spot, got me in a neck brace, got me in a helicopter, you know, and then I spent a few months at the Kessler Institute for Rehabilitation. The week I arrived, Christopher Reeve was on the cover of Time magazine. Christopher was an outpatient patient there when I was an inpatient patient there. The doctors and the physical therapists, you know, when I was there, I went in July, it was July 4th weekend, got out Halloween day. You know, the doctors and everyone there, you know, they don't lie to you. Nobody told me, hey, Evan, you're going to walk again. Nobody knew. I started to be able to have a little bit of movement in my leg, and they were like, okay, that's great. That's maybe all you're going to get. So let's do another 10 reps in the wheelchair. And then I started to get a little more return. And then I could stand up, and they were like, okay, this is good, but you know, you might not be able to walk. And then it was, I could walk a little bit. You got to understand, you know, there's a real gray area from like dark gray to very light gray in what the definition of walking is. Like what is walking? You know, walking is the ability to move from one place to another. So if I walk with my two canes and my leg braces 100 yards, is that walking? Well, I think it is, but is it walking, you know, if I'm using a walker or if I'm, you know, holding onto a wheelchair? For about a year and a half, almost 2 years, I was somewhere in between. I would need a wheelchair to go longer places. I would need a walker to go around my apartment or whatnot. But then I got to this good place. You know, because I was a young man at the time, I was in good shape, and I committed myself to physical therapy and to working. I mean, I worked out five, six days a week for 2 hours at the Hollywood Y. We moved to LA. My wife, my aunt and I moved to LA, and mostly to avoid walking around the city because I kept tripping. And I'll tell you this, every New Yorker like next to me couldn't have been nicer and helping my feet every time. And, you know, that's the great thing about New York. But I needed to be in a place where I could drive and, you know, and right. But I eventually got to a good place with it. And for many years, I just used a cane and now I use one or two. And you know, I'm in my early 50s and I use leg braces in addition.
Thanks for sharing that. What people didn't understand about the whole story of cabin fever, although it came a little later, I mean, you were dealing with this. Was there a point in time where you were just like, everything that I've worked for, because you know how grueling the making movies and making entertainment can be, was there ever a point in time where you're like, I have to figure out what I'm going to do? Or did you not even think about that and just focus on rehabilitation?
No, the good news is that all of my physical rehabilitation happened beforehand, because we shot Cabin Fever in 2001. So from 96 to about 98, almost into 99, I was kind of out of commission, let's say, because all I did do was work out and see doctors. But I was also writing scripts. And at the same time, Gustavo and I were working on Dead in the Water. And then things just started to happen, good things. And then I realized when you're on a movie set and you're the producer, if there are director's chairs, and let's say they're 200 feet away, if you're nice, and I tend to be nice, and I ask a production assistant or an AD, hey, can you bring it over here? I need to sit down for a few minutes. Most people will be glad, you know, glad to do that. That's kind of part of their job description, is to just, you know, move Video Village around. And sometimes I need an extra chair more than anybody. And that's okay. I don't abuse it, and I'm always very thankful, and I remember those who helped me. So,
yeah, you thank the people of New York.
It can be grueling. It's very true, but you got to make it work. I chose to make it work as opposed to not.
You didn't wallow in poor me. You did exactly the opposite.
No, I was fortunate because, I mean, I would say two things happened. When I was in the hospital, I was completely delusional that I was like, I'm going to walk. Like, come on. I'm going to walk. And I remember the doctors being like, okay, like, just let Evan believe what Evan's going to believe. It's a very common problem for doctors. Like, I never accepted my situation. Meaning, you know, when I was in an electric wheelchair, you know, at the beginning, I was like, no, I'm going to get out of this thing. And luckily I did. I never had to get to the place where I had to accept that my physical limitations were going to be life-altering, meaning that I'd have to choose a different career, or I couldn't do this, or I could do anything an able-bodied person could do, just slower.
Right.
And needed a little bit of assistance from time to time. So that was kind of part A of it. And, you know, the second part of it is, as long as I take care of my body, physical therapy, working out, stretching, eating right, doing all the things that you're supposed to do in life, then it's kept me nimble into my 50s, you know, and I'm still going to sets, you know, asking for that director's chair, you know, that still happens.
Yep.
You know,
thanks for sharing that. Cause I know it's who you are as a person and you don't shy away from it. And I think anybody who's out there listening, whatever you might think your physical limitations are, or, you know, we all get in our own heads about things, you know, you're a person to look up to, as far as like, you definitely could have thrown in the towel and been like, I'm gonna just sit in my chair and rot away. And you did exactly, you didn't even, that never even entered your mind at any time. So,
and luckily, to this day, you don't even make a thing of it. Like, when you ask for a chair, people don't know that you need a chair. They just think, oh, this guy's the boss, get him a chair. You don't make it anyone's problem, and you don't ask for any favors.
I try not to, because I also say this, is that when you're in a place like Kessler Institute, when there's guys like Christopher Reeve, you know, who is in a wheelchair that's being controlled by his breath, and there's so many other individuals that are not getting up out of that wheelchair, that are going to be disabled, you know, for life, that stuff doesn't leave your consciousness. So I'm pretty lucky. I'll leave it there. You know, I'm lucky to be able to do what I do, and I enjoy it. So there you go.
And I think at your darkest hour, that you had a vision that you had to survive to make Zombievers, right?
Oh,
I
mean, that's
is that where you're like, that's where the inspirato came for Zombievers?
I will say this, like, as a film producer, you never know what films that you're working on are going to get financed, when or if at all. When I was, you know, the most active in the film industry, I'd have 12, 15 projects I was developing because I knew like that was the ratio to get one going. But then as I got more experience, I was able to kind of hone in on the ones I really loved and then, mm-hmm. you know, kind of push those through. But the truth of it is that sometimes films just get, you know, just get financed, like Zombievers. Like did I think that film was going to get financed? I don't know. You know, like it was a weird movie.
Yeah, you never said there's no way this is going to happen.
I never say that about any film because you never know what's going to happen. I had films that I was fucking certain that, like, why is this film's going to get made? And then it didn't. I mean, I got more of those than I got, you know, wins. And that's okay. That's part of the game. You got to try, you know, and you got to keep trying.
So tell the story of that. You were friends with the writer director and he said, dude, I've got the film.
I got a beaver movie.
It was even better than that. Jordan Rubin and I grew up in the same building in Manhattan when we were both like, 6 years old or 8 years old. His mom and my mom are still friends. Jordan was a successful comedian and comedic writer. I think he was on season 1 and 2 of the Chappelle Show and done as a writer and done a lot of cool stuff in comedy. I ran into him when I was working out at the damn Hollywood Y, you know, like, and we reconnected. We hadn't seen each other in like 10 years. You know, he had, you know, seen, you know, known I was making films and, you know, we kept in touch about stuff. And he calls me out of the blue and he says, hey, Evan, can I pitch you a film I'm going to write with two of my comedy buddies? I want to get your take on it because we're trying to decide if we're going to write it or not. I'm like, all right. So they pitched me the entire film in like 8 minutes, the whole thing on the phone, like, you know, out of the blue. And I'm laughing. I'm like, these guys are funny. Like, it's a funny pitch, man. I was like, oh, that's awesome. So Jordan says to me, okay, you like it? I'm like, yeah, that's great. And it's called Zombievers. Like, that's, he's like, yeah. I'm like, dude, I love it. Like, I think it's, I'm like, great. So you're going to go write it? And I'm thinking, great, you know, I'm going to get the script in like either never or like in a year. Right. He goes, yeah. Never. He goes, all right, cool. I'll send it to you in like 2 weeks. I'm like, sure, buddy. Sounds good.
Whatever.
Right. 2 weeks later to the day, bing, you've got mail. And there it is. And I think we did one round of notes that were really minimal and it was ready to go. Like, that's what we shot.
Looks like a beaver dam. Let's go take a look.
You girls from out of town?
We're staying over there in my cousin's place. We were looking for beavers.
Well, hell, ain't we all?
Well, I've had enough excitement for one day. What was that? Someone in there?
There's a beaver in the bathroom! Kill it!
We got in front of a bunch of financiers. I went to Uncle Cassian. He wanted to do it. And his money guys at the time that he had a deal with didn't want to do it for whatever reason. Long story long, we got it financed. It took about, we pitched it everywhere. And I thought, oh no, this one's not going to get going either. This is so stupid. The script is so great. And Jordan is awesome. He reminded me of Eli, but you know, he had a much more buttoned up sensibility and, you know, his comedic chops were just so on point. And we found some equity financiers. We partnered with the guys at a company that's called Good Fear now. They used to be called Bender Spink. So Chris Bender and JC Spink and Jake Weiner produced the film with us. And they had a couple of equity guys, Chris Lamole and Tim Zajaros, that also produced the film with us. And it was a great experience. You know, we shot all here in LA and it's the film that my kids talk about the most. They haven't seen it yet because it's like, it's a hard R, but the title gets people excited.
Gets them going. Yeah, exactly.
John Mayer and Bill Burr have a scene together that Jordan wrote, and then he let them improvise.
So 4 months later, she's pregnant again, you know? So we're going back down to the clinic. She's crying, do you love me, and all that type of stuff. I told her I did, but do you think that means I'm going to hell? You know, I dated a guy once.
Could I hear all about it?
I mean, there's not a lot to tell. It's like one of the easiest weeks of my life other than the sex. That was brutal. You know, it's not the dick, it's the whiskers, man. It just creeps you out. You know, we just agreed on everything. Want to get some beers? Yeah. Want to watch the game? Absolutely.
You get beers, and we watch the game. I hear a lot of myself in this story.
There's none of you in this story, man. It was a one-time thing.
The outtakes of that should, you know, I think are probably on a Blu-ray somewhere, but they're better. You know, they're better than anything. It was a fun movie to make.
I there's so many that I really want to talk about, and I know that, you know, Zombievers has become one of those, as they say, a cult classic. There's so many people who reference it. I hear that name even today. Another one that you had a really big part of was the Star Wars fanboys.
Yep, that's what, okay. Hilarious, everyone. Looks like we got more Lucas hounds here to mock Roddenberry. Congratulations, gentlemen, but I would like to see your Darth Vader take on one Borg drone. We'll see who's laughing there. Am I right?
Darth Vader could put the entire Borg collective in a vice grip with his mind.
Darth Vader has asthma, so name me one Star Trek character with a respiratory disease, because I'm drawing a blank.
Name me one Star Wars character who's gay.
Yeah.
Besides you.
Well, I know it's gay in Star Trek, so why would I even do that?
Captain Picard.
Okay, Captain Picard is not gay. He's British.
Come on.
Yeah, fanboys.
Yeah, fanboys is about fanboys. The best film that I produced. My son loves it. Like, my kids like it. My wife, that's like the one film my wife likes, you know? My wife's like, what is all these zombie movies like you're doing? The thing about fanboys is that I was developing it with at this point I was, you know, I made Cabin Fever, you know, people knew me in the town and reading a lot of scripts, and I was pushing a lot of material around, and I had a lot of things in the fire. And then these younger guys, young kind of group of filmmakers that had gone to NYU, a bunch of them, Kyle Newman and Matt Panisaro, maybe 8 or 10 years younger than me, had come to me about this film that this unknown writer named Ernest Cline, who wrote Ready Player One, he hadn't written it yet, had wrote this play called Fanboys. And I liked the pitch. Kyle and a couple of his NYU buddies had done a draft of the script, and it just wasn't there. And I was working with them to try to get it there. And we brought in a couple of writers that are all writing for free. And I remember thinking, like, this is a waste of my time. But it wasn't moving forward. Right, the script wasn't evolving, and I knew Kyle was frustrated, and I knew Matt was a little frustrated. And then they came to me and said, "Hey, Evan, the option's up on the play for Ernie. Could you write Ernie $1,000 check?" And I was like, "Are you fucking kidding me? Like, oh my god, I'm like losing faith in this, and I got to write $1,000 check." And of course, I did it. Kyle then called me. Kyle and Matt called me and said, "We think we've got the writer that's going to take this over the finish line. Would you come meet him?" And I was like, "Sure, I'll buy you guys lunch again." So we go out to Cantor's, and it was Adam F. Goldberg, who eventually went on to, he's, you know, a massive comedy, you know, producer, writer. The Goldbergs is his show, and many others. Adam was like a young TV writer and loved the script and pitched us back his version of the film that night. And it was essentially what we shot. And I was like, "Adam, if you can really write what you just pitched me, dude, fucking good on you. Like, I'm excited again." And he went off and did it, just wrote it. We got the draft like in a month, and it was amazing. And I was like, thank God I wrote that $1,000 check. So, and then we were off the races, you know, and, you know, we'd gotten the biggest stumbling block on that film from a financial standpoint, getting it financed. Everybody asked, well, what are you going to do about George Lucas? Because, you know, there's like Lucas stuff everywhere in the film. And at the time, I had accepted a job as the VP of production for Kevin Spacey's production company, Trigger Street. And this was before Kevin's legal problems that are currently in the news media. And Kevin knew George through his celebrity, was able to get George to kind of give us the keys to the kingdom. And we got a letter from Lucasfilm saying, from George saying, I love the script. I support your efforts. Use anything you want. Go for it.
Featuring Princess Leia, Lando Calrissian, Darth Maul, Shooter McGavin, the warehouse guy from The Office, the guy from Tropic Thunder, Jay, the guy from Die Hard 4, the hot chick from Sin City, and Captain James T. Kirk.
Friend of yours?
Fanboys.
We would send a photocopy of that letter attached to the script when we sent it out to financiers. And then we did like 20 meetings in like 2 weeks. Everybody said they wanted to finance it. And I was like, we're going to make a big studio. It was going to be a studio film, you know? And then Harvey Weinstein came back and said, no, I want it. I'm going to finance it. Let's go. Like, path to production deal. You guys are going to go location scouting next week. I'm writing you a check. He had just left the Disney deal and just started the Weinstein Company. He had a lot of money, and Cassian Elways brokered the deal for us. We were making the film like 5 months later with Seth Rogen and Kristen Bell and Jay Baruchel. And that's how we made Fanboys.
And beloved Fanboys. It's amazing. You know, Lucas, everyone thinks of him as being enigmatic and hard to deal with and stuff. But when he gets behind projects, and I know that the guys over at Family Guy and Robot Chicken, who have done a bunch of Star Wars stuff, that almost like makes kind of mocks, or I don't know if mocks is the right word, but he loves that stuff. He gets behind it.
Look, I've never met the man, but I've been to his ranch, and we know they let us shoot on the ranch, you know? So,
right.
You know, look, I got nothing but good things to say about them. And it was a really great experience. And
people love that movie, Evan.
It's a fun movie. You
people
know,
people love that movie.
It got re-edited by Harvey, and there was a whole period of like BS around that. And, you know, the film didn't really get released properly. If I didn't really get released at all, which was a pisser, but the film's out there now, and people that know it love it, and people that want to find it, because at the end of the day, he made a great little movie, and everybody that's in the film, that produced the film, there was a lot of love in that film. I say that because our line producer met his current wife on the film, and Matt met, you know, was, he's not with her anymore, but like, you know, we met his longtime girlfriend on the film, and Kyle met his, you know, the mother of his children on that film, you know, so there was a lot of love in that film, maybe a little too much, but you know, it was all good. You know, we had a really, in a lot of ways, it's like a full circle experience with Cabin Fever. We had a good time making the film. It was hard. We weren't sitting in bougie trailers. You know, we were out there doing it in New Mexico, getting it done, 25-day schedule, long days, but everybody was behind it. Everybody wanted to do it. They wanted to be there, which is so important.
Right.
If there's anything we didn't talk about, if there's anything that you maybe share with, because we all love to work with and be exposed to the youthful exuberance of young filmmakers. You know, a lot of our sets are filled with them. And even just the other day, like a kid that worked for a good buddy of mine was like, sir, you know, can I maybe buy you coffee and ask you some questions? I'm like, sure, kid, you know, and it was great to just he's what, I don't know, 26. He went to NYU, just graduated, he's out here, and it was great to just be like, do this, don't do that, here's what I did.
Well, I love that. I'd say I'll flip it on you, Ryan. Let's tell the short version of Whoa. Like, what was the first call I made to you about Whoa?
Read the script. You have until tomorrow. Call me after. Bye. And then
you're out.
You sent me a script. Now, look, it's not a great story, but I think it's pertinent.
I disagree. It is a great story.
It's pertinent to young filmmakers, because I think a lot of people, and I would agree that in today's world and market, this is tough. There was a time, I think, where you, and I'm currently producing a movie in LA right now, where a young filmmaker could come out to LA, they could have an idea of a script, they could meet people, bring a team together, they could all kind of trade, work in the trade of, if you do this for me, I'll do this for you, and that's how things get done. And you could do that, and you could make a movie, and please, you guys know this as well, correct me if I'm wrong, but you could make a movie like that. Well, and this wasn't that long ago.
That's how this started. So Matt Goodhue, who I'd worked with in the commercial world, was an editor and a shooter, and he was a young guy that wanted to make a movie.
Yep.
And I kept encouraging him, like, write a script. And he wrote a really cool dramatic horror film. And he calls me up and he's like, look, I've got like $50,000. I got a camera package from Panavision or something, and I want to make this film. What do I do?
Yeah.
I'm beyond the $50,000 film, at least right now. And I couldn't see myself doing, but I said, okay, I'll tell you what. I think I know the guy. And I called Ryan because Ryan was making some films. It was producing films. And I think I don't want to say I had to convince you, but I had said, look, I think Matt should make this movie like now. And I think it's something you guys could just go do.
Yeah.
And then I remember you had to kind of convince Matt that, like, let's shoot it in 3 weeks or whatever it was. And he was like, what? No, we're going to shoot it in, like, we got to develop it and cast it. And you were like, no, you don't have money for that. Dude, we're making this film in like a month or whatever it was.
No, in fact, one of the things you said, and I think this is good advice, I just gave this advice to someone this week, which was, I have saved $50,000 or $70,000, which is a lot of money for people.
Yeah, that's real money.
It's real money. And should I make a teaser or should I make a short film? And your advice is, if you have the money and you can figure out how to do it, why not just shoot the movie? Just figure out a way to shoot the movie. And I gave that exact advice to someone literally 3 days ago.
Well, that's how Whoa got made, because I said Ryan will know how to make this film for this amount of money. It was the right script. Yes, the budget sucked, but it was doable. And the long story short is that you guys made the film. It came out really well. And it was what? New York Times.
I forget. I'm sorry. It's terrible. It's like, I should, like, give the, like, guy
one
a
of the best horror films of the year or filmmakers to watch.
He got another directing job out of it. And you're like, he's definitely on his way. I mean, I remember reading the script and I called you back and I said, wait, how much money does he have? And I said,
I was like, I don't know. Here, talk to Matt. And we're like, Pat's edit. And I'm like, go, let's go.
I said, I think we can do this, Matt. I said, look, I'll go. I really like this. Look, these guys know me. I'll just share this. My life has been affected by suicide. It's something that I think people need to talk about. It's hidden in our society. It's a big cause of death in this world. It happens all the time. It's kind of a plague in the US as much as anything else. And Matt had written it about suicide and about a family that's suffering from suicide, and had written pretty clever horror. Now, what's on screen at the end of the day, we had to change some stuff, and that's just the way the process goes. But I bought into it. And I'll never forget this. So we go from a cold nothing, deep space, nothing happening, to Evan sending me the script, us having a conversation with Matt saying, let's go do this. And within less than a week, we put all the people together, and people did get paid. They didn't get paid, freight, but regular freight, but they got paid. And we also did it non-union, which is very hard to do in this town, but it was such a low budget, we didn't get messed with. So that all being said, I think this was a Thursday evening, I get an email from Matt saying that we are going, like we're going on the next Monday. And I get an email from Matt saying, hey, Ryan, I don't think we should do this. So I'm just sending you this email to tell you I'm backing out. I didn't even call Evan. I just picked up.
Yeah, I was about to say, I don't think I heard this, but
I didn't call it. I didn't call you. I picked up the phone Thursday night. I said, hey, thanks for answering the phone. He's like, yeah, are you calling me about the, and I stopped him. I said, the email. And he said, yeah. And I go, you could have at least had the spine to call me and tell me on the phone instead of sending me the shit email that you're backing out of this, you quitter. And I really just got pretty bullied. I bullied him into making it.
Good. That's what producers have to do. You did the right thing.
Yeah, I bullied him into making it. And after Shudder bought the movie, and basically we paid back our investors. I think Matt made his money back. Hopefully. Yeah, I think I'm pretty sure. Look, whatever it is, it was his first film. We paid investors back. And it got bought by Shudder. It's available out there. It sold, and it was a $70,000 movie.
And you know the best thing about it is it's good.
It's not a bad. It won a lot of awards. It won a lot of awards.
It's really hard to do at that budget level.
Impossible.
So kudos to Matt and to you. You guys did a great job.
But I had to drag that young lad kicking and screaming. I mean, we had I bullied him into making it, but there was a time I'll never forget this. He said, Ryan, there were 10,000 times on this movie where I should have listened to you. And I look back now and go and say, I just want you to know I should have taken your, where you said do B and I did what I wanted to do. I should have done what you said. But that all being said, I want you to know how much I appreciate the fact that you physically bullied me into making this movie.
Look, some directors need, you know, a stronger hand. Some need, you know, to get out of their way. Every director is different. Every filmmaker is different. And every film is different. So, you know, you brought to Matt what he needed to help him in the way that would, you know, help the film.
And
that's our job.
Yeah, I mean, he's a fantastic young writer. He's a fantastic editor. Like, he's kind of a guy who can do it all. And that's sometimes what you need when you're young. You need to be able to make titles and be able to edit. Yeah, it was a great experience. I really enjoyed it. I really liked the movie. I will say this also, we were talking about film festivals earlier. One of the biggest issues, I think, is that, you know, we submitted to South by Southwest and Toronto and Sundance and all that. And I think we've had conversations, Alex, and you and I had had conversations about submitting to these places, because it's really hard for films like that to get into those things. And you have to pay money to do that.
And nobody tells you that. They say, go make your film, young person. And then you go, okay. And then you get enough money to make it. And then you have a finished film, thank God, or maybe, you know, a lot don't, but you get it done. And then it's like, now what?
Yeah.
And there's a whole like sharks waiting for you to jump in, like, oh, more product that we can take advantage of. It's kind of like you're a prospector out and, you know, you're Daniel Plainview and you bring in your, you know, gold nuggets to the town and they're like, we're gonna take everything, kid, just wait, you know.
And the crazy thing is that there's no just to write a film. And this is what I have friends who've made movies, they've written stuff, they've filmed the stuff, they've edited the stuff, but they don't like finish it. They don't finish it. And it sits on hard drives and they talk about it. And I'm like, the one thing I said to Matt was, I'm going to drag you kicking and screaming to start this. But once we start it, we are not stopping till it's done. And we worked hard together for a long time to finish that movie. And it's not for everybody, but it is, you know, it's 78% on Rotten Tomatoes. It got written up in the New York Times. It didn't get into the big film festivals, but it's hard for that, a film like this to do. But it did, the film festivals that it did get into, it cleaned up. It did a great, it cleaned up, and I'm very proud of that. But it is, I think, Evan, to your point, if you have a script, if people read it and say, you got to do something with this, and if you have any type of funding whatsoever, just go out. Why aren't you? I think what you said to me that first conversation is, why aren't you making this right now? You have, like, figure out a way to make it and make it. And that's true, because no one is handing directors jobs.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of what I said to Matt. I was like, look, I'm missing something here. You have the money, you got a camera, you got a house, you already have the lead actor. Like,
what?
You just need somebody, you got to put it together? Great, hold on. I got the guy. Yeah, let's go. And then you guys were like making the movie. So.
Yeah. And in some ways, by the way, in some ways, that's kind of what happened with Alex in Hollow Body. I mean, that's exactly, you know, Alex
is high voltage,
right? Released as High Voltage, but it will always be Hollow Body to me. That's the thing, is that Alex fought to get his financing. Like, these are all, this all goes into the 1% of the 1% conversation that I have with Matt and I have with everybody. It's a 1% chance you finish a good script. There's a 1% chance you actually get the money to film a movie. There's a 1% chance you're going to actually film it and complete it. There's a 1% chance you're going to edit it and put it all together. And the reason it's 1% is because people just quit. They just can't. It's a long road. People don't understand. People, like, even family members, and I'm sure you guys have run into this, there are family members out there who are like, when's that movie coming out? That you, like, they don't understand that this is a 2-year process, maybe even 3, like
minimum.
I mean, look, here's the flip side of that, Evan, the positive side. Is Cabin, you still getting checks for Cabin Fever?
That's what they tell me. They're getting small, you know, but it's all good.
But it rebooted. It rebooted. It sequelized. It keeps going.
Yeah.
So if you get the lottery ticket of something that you guys were in the and woods,
20 years later, the woods of Carolina is still paying off,
ran out of town.
Oh,
like,
my God.
if you get it's that, if you make money it
for me to run out of town.
But you know what I'm saying. I mean, and by the way, what kind of risk was that to go out into the woods with $250,000 of Mr. Fulick's money and not even know if you had the money to finish it? Like, that is, you got to, like,
let alone get paid, which we weren't, but it's all true. So those are all, you know, all those lessons are applicable.
Yeah.
Please join us for other episodes of How I Got Greenlit, including our amazing conversation with mega producer Craig Perry as he discusses just how hard it is to make a living in the business of show.
I teach classes. I take them through this entire spiel. It's about 15 minutes long, where I describe the process of finding a piece of material. And I go through the class and cast every member of the class as, you're an executive, you're an agent, you're a director, you're an editor, so that they all feel like they're participating in what is usually a 7-year process.
Yeah, that, I think a lot of people
don't. From the script to getting it made, and which a producer gets paid nothing. In fact, the moment that makes the class usually gasp with horror is, I say, you worked for, let's say, 15 months getting the script to exactly where it needs to be with this guy who's still living in his parents' basement. But the script is great. Oh my God, it's sold for 3 against 6, $300,000. How much does the producer get? Nothing. Mm-hmm. You get zero. And they just say, well, how do you live? I'm like, ain't that the bitch? Yeah. Ain't that the treasure? That's the challenge.
That was Craig Perry discussing how to make films and how to make a living while making films. Because as the man once said, it's easy to make a killing in showbiz. It's hard to make a living.
Welcome back to How I Got Greenlit. I'm your host, Ryan Gibson, with Alex Collegian. We're here with Evan Ostrowski, producer of Cabin Fever and many, many others. And we're going to go into talking about the film he brought us today, which is Michael Mann's Manhunter. Let's take it away. Why did you choose Manhunter, Evan?
Well, every film that I think you could say you love or you have a kind of personal connection to, it, for me at least, you know, like it's not just like, oh, I saw it and I loved it. I had never seen Manhunter growing up for obvious reasons. There's no way that film, you know, was probably on TV. And then I was a PA on Coppola's Dracula back when I was at NYU over Christmas break, just for like 4 weeks. And Coppola had a VHS library in the production office where I worked that anybody could take anything out, you know, and it was like, you know, it was like 300 or 400 video, you know, VHSs. And I had been asked to kind of jump on the film at the end as they were trying to like get everything done and blah, blah, blah. So like the first weekend, I was like, oh, I'm going to take a VHS home. And I looked at the sign out list and I looked at what Francis had taken out the most throughout the like 3 months I'd missed of production. And it was Manhunter. And I was like, what the fuck is that? And then I saw it like right in front of me. So I signed it out and I took it home and I watched it. And man, that film had an effect on me. I mean, that was like a kick in the nuts. It's really hard for me personally to get scared in films. I got like horror films or thrillers. I mostly like, particularly horror films, you know, mostly I'd like laugh, you know, or I'd, through like the gory stuff. And I mean, you know, that's why I was so attracted to kind of like a few films I made. But like Manhunter, you know, that's a fucked up movie. That movie is fucked up. And I love William Peterson's performance in it. I love the Michael Mann's mastery of filmmaking, you know, his use of music between score, track, needle drop. I thought that Tim Noonan, everybody was so on point on that film. And it was just so well done. So, and I'm a huge Michael Mann fan.
Yeah.
And so that's why I thought about it. You know, that's why I thought about it. It's a great film by a great filmmaker that maybe not everybody has seen. I feel like, you know, Thief was his first film, the James Caan film. A lot of people have seen that film because it's like his first film. And I think directors' first films are often kind of sought after, you know, by film fans, you know, to kind of see where they begin. But I think this was Michael's second film. And at the time,
his second film was The Keep. And we're not allowed to talk about that. It's been
called.
Oh, okay. Well,
not even no Blu-ray imminent on that one.
I think that he had made this film either right before or right in the middle of his Miami Vice years.
Right.
And let me tell you, there's a definite one-to-one going on in the style.
Oh, you feel it. See it? You can tell he was testing.
Sliding door.
Nationwide victims.
Yeah, this is Will Graham of the FBI.
One killer.
This is what the subject's teeth look like.
Whatever the tricks he learned, you know, with Sonny and Crockett are like all over this film. And by the way, I fucking love Miami Vice.
Yeah.
I fucking love that
show. Absolutely. Yeah. That was the, I don't want to get too, we should have you back and talk about Miami Vice, but you know, like the 7 minute Phil Collins, driving in his Ferrari. Yeah. Like that was never done before.
Is the definitive use of that song. Everyone else who came after.
Suck it.
Including Todd Phillips.
Yeah. The Mike Tyson punch, right?
Right.
Yeah.
By the way, a little history, and Alex obviously being our vault of film history. The first chapter in the Hannibal Lecter series, am I right, Alex?
Yeah.
Because
a book called Red Dragon.
Yep.
And I think it was Dino De Laurentiis picked up the rights, and still to this day, his company retains the rights of all the Thomas Harris Lecter verse, if you will. And yeah, he was the one who said, "No, that's Red Dragon. What is it? Are we making a sword and sorcery movie? Right. It's got to be something more clear.
Are there elves in this?"
Yeah. And kind of anointed man. I mean, Dino is a really interesting figure in film. Some people love him, some people hate him, but he is the guy that gives Michael Mann his first real budget, his first studio film. He's the guy who gave David Lynch a break with Blue Velvet. He's a guy who gave the Wachowski brothers their first film with Bound. Say what you will, but the guy...
He's not afraid of supporting that some crazy visions.
Yeah. I mean, and let's just talk about the film in a macro. I mean, arguably, I think that the creators of CSI and every copy of it owe Michael Mann a residual check.
Yes.
This was the first time we saw modern day forensics that was not Quincy MD, the sort of high tech science of reading the fingerprints that you can't see with the naked eye and the lasers and the this and the that and all that sort of bringing in all these like incredibly smart people. It's not a detective, you know, it wasn't the usual like, well, my intuition tells me this guy is guilty. It was using high tech and, you know, modern communication. And I remember it was the first time I saw fax on a plane.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of a ticking bomb film in a sense that...
Yes, because they're going to strike.
Yeah,
yes.
Because, you know, they know that the Tooth Fairy is going to strike again. And
on a lunar cycle.
And they know when he's going to strike because he's all about like the lunar cycle. And so William Peterson and all, you know, and Dennis Farina and, you know, his...
Farina's so good in this.
...are like chasing this guy down. And what is that great line that the lab tech says, you know, you are so sly, but so am I.
But
you know,
so am I.
It's like, oh yeah, man, we're like the FBI is coming for you, man. But I will say that towards the end of the film, to ruin it for everybody, when they kind of burst through the door into, you know, the Tooth Fairy's home, I honestly didn't think it'd be that violent. Like the Tooth Fairy like offs like three cops in like 12 seconds. And then William Peterson like bursts through the window, gets his face sliced open. Tom Noonan throws him across the room. I'm like, oh my God, they're going to kill the lead character. Holy shit, what is about to happen? It doesn't happen. You know, well, William Peterson gets the better of him. And the other thing that I think that the film does really well is, you know, William Peterson at the beginning of the film is scarred by his experience that happens off screen with Hannibal Lecter, how he caught Hannibal Lecter, which is, you know, how the series begins. And so he's this really broken guy, and he has to then go back and face Lecter. And so the kind of PTSD of what the police do day to day plays heavy in the film, which I thought was really ahead of its time, particularly today where mental health is so important in kind of today's culture across the board. So that coloring around those characters in that story, I think make it unique. It didn't fall into a trope, you know, at all. Michael Mann, he just wouldn't let it, which was great. And let's face it, he had a great book to base it on. So good for him.
Absolutely. I want to speak to the, you're so sly, but so am I. Michael Mann said that became the, you know, like on a film set, there's like certain beloved scenes or lines or whatever that almost become like part of the vernacular of the set. So he said when, you know, a dolly did a particularly amazing push for a dolly grip for a move, or, you know, the cameraman got the perfect shot, or an actor nailed the, you know, they would say cut. And then the guy would go like, you're so sly, but so am I. Like it became like the attaboy on the set. Yeah. And what I love about this film too, is like, I'm a huge Miami Vice guy. And I love when directors start to either purposely or just because it's comfortable, create a repertory company, right? So like the guy who played the scientist that says the sly line is Bill Simatrovich, and he was in Miami Vice, many different, roles. You know, he always shows up in Michael Mann movies, and he kind of gave him his career. And then, of course, you know, Dennis Farina, right after this is when they decided to work together on Crime Story, and he actually gave him his first role. He was a working Chicago cop when Thief was being filmed and hired him to play a heavy in that film, like a shotgun wielding scary guy who I don't think had any lines. And of course, like Stephen Lang turns up in Crime Story and in a lot of subsequent Mann films. So it's great to see that when they just have this like shorthand with a certain actor and they can't get enough of them, you know? Whereas like Thief, we think of James Caan. Oh my God. I mean, he recently passed away, rest in peace. And, you know, all his interviews,
he pretty much
copped that was his best role.
He lived a good life, by the way.
Yeah. The best scene I ever acted was in Thief, that 10 minute dialogue scene of just about being a prisoner and growing up in
such a good movie. Blah, blah.
And I mean, what's great about this film is you're right. It's very much touched by the color palette, the style, the music, even the clothes. He basically used most of his keys from Miami Vice. He said, guys, we're making a movie. And just grabbed, you know, like people who already like anointed as very talented and like production design and things like that. And that's why we get that, you know, Mel Bourne, Bonnie Timmerman, like these are people that helped Miami Vice become Miami Vice. And he just brought them along. What's cool is it's almost like you always expect these very dark films to be very dark. You know, I think of Seven. Seven is just like it's super dark. Right.
Yeah.
But this film actually has a lot of like he went the other way with it. It's amazing to see the two scenes of Silence of the Lambs and Manhunter and the inevitable, like, let's go pick Hannibal Lecter's brain, right? So we all know the Silence of the Lambs ones. It's gothic. It's dark. It's a basement. It's stone. It's you know, it's very creepy and like old haunted house kind of vibe. So what does Man do? All white tile, all white everything, and it's super bright.
I wonder if he was kind of trapped in Miami, like between seasons, and he had to just. I think it was.
I think they shot it between in the summer between
the same, you know,
because it's all shot in the South too.
Yeah. He was like, "Hey guys, guess what? Guess what we're doing on, you know, on summer break? Yeah. You know,
we got a gig." Yeah.
You know, one of the other things for me, you know, because I found out about it through working on Dracula, when I watched Dracula. I'm like trying to figure out like what did Coppola see in that film that he applied to Dracula, which is another film anybody could say, you know, is a great B-side of one of Coppola's films. What is it that he saw in that film? And I started to think, well, is it how he structured Gary Oldman's character? You know, is he kind of like a 17th century serial killer? Is he like that demented, like Jack the demonic Ripper. And, you know, like what's going on there? That's a harder one-to-one to really connect those dots. But I honestly really feel it's the tone that Michael Mann creates. So brilliantly. Michael Mann's, I think one of his great gifts as a director is tone. And that's created from everything, every tool in the director's toolbox, from music to acting to production design, camera movement, all those kind of things. And I think that, you know, when you watch that film, I wonder to myself in the, you know, the real bloody, you know, sequences of Dracula, did Coppola kind of get some tips and tricks from his buddy Michael Mann on like how to make a serial killer like cup sequence or whatnot. But we'll never know because Francis doesn't return my calls anymore. But anyways.
But
and that was one of my favorites of his too. Talk about a great B side. I mean, that is just an underappreciated Coppola movie. So next time you come back, let's do that one. But
yeah,
I think it's a huge stepping stone for Mann. I think Thief was such a just dynamic debut. This was the next logical step. Incredibly, it did not do that well commercially because now I think how it just sort of resonated through culture. It was almost like too early for such a thing, but it was very shocking. Some of the stuff he did, but it's not that gory a film. It's almost implied mayhem. True. You know,
it's pretty intense. Like, it's pretty intense,
very creepy. Like the whole scene where he goes through the house, adopting the first person concept of being the killer himself, right? His special skill, the Will Graham magic. I need the magic, man. You know, you see the effects of the murder, and the theater of the mind is much more terrifying, right?
Well, he has those great cutaways to the victims, and he's in the house at night, and that shit's creepy.
Yes.
The art of the stalk is pretty crazy in that movie.
And he's killing families and women, and
and you see the bloodstains in the children's room.
And best use of a wheelchair I've ever seen in a film. So lets the guy on fire
and wheels him.
Lets him go down. Let's him go down Jesus. The ramp.
Well, okay, maybe that is kind of gory. That was pretty
heavy, was good. It was well.
But you don't really see anything, and it's one of my favorite. It's a bygone trick for stuntmen. The Burning Man. Have you guys ever got to use a Burning Man in any of your films?
Yeah, Cabin Fever 1, man. That's what we did that. Yeah.
I mean, I fucking love that. So that just it entails. It's very old school. They just cover the stunt person in a lot of protective gear. They coat their skin and they light them on fire.
Yep.
And they do the classic like Frankenstein arm wave, and like I can't get enough of it. And then they fall over. Like The Thing used it a lot, stuff like that. But I go back to Farina in this film because you rewatch it. You're obviously riveted by the plot. Maybe the first go around, you're just kind of following along, but when you watch it at, 10 times or whatever, as I have, I'm looking at Farina, like he's just great. Like there's a subtle moment where they get Freddie Lowndes, the reporter, the tabloid reporter, and they said, well, let's use him to flush out the killer. So Will Graham agrees to a interview. And so to purposely goad the killer to try to strike at him, he implies stuff like, oh, well, he might wear dresses and he might, have been molested.
Yeah. Sex with his mother, molested or whatever.
Sex with an animal. And you just see Farina chuckle in the background, like, I didn't know we were coming. and he has to like hide it so that the reporter doesn't know they're full of shit. Stuff like that is just great. And even the concept, Peterson plays it beautifully. You can tell how torturous that his skill is. Theme of it is, hey, you have this gift. Well, what's that? Well, you can pretend to be a serial killer. Well, what's the implication? Like, he's one shade away from actually being a serial killer.
Oh, yeah. He wakes up on the wrong side of the bed. Dude, he is Hannibal Lecter.
And the wife and the kid don't want to be around him because they're smelling it on him. Like, we're not safe in the house with you, are we? And I love the whole Farina thing of coming there and saying, I need you, I need the Blade Runner magic one more time. It's like the classic reluctant hero thing. You get a wider world. Like, I always love heroes or stories where there's already a wider world and adventures that they've had, and we're just coming in on this one, right? It's like The Godfather. Oh, well, yeah, there was a story about the band leader. And so you get the legend, right? You kind of build up the legend. So in this case, here's characters we don't know. He walks in. Hey, man, I got to get you to do this thing. And you hear a little bit of hints about how bad the last job was. And he's kind of retired because it was so, dangerous and traumatic and blah, blah, blah. And then he just gives him the picture. And in your mind's eye, you're like, oh, it's a photo of like a headless corpse and a topless bar or whatever, right? And then you see that the picture is just a family.
Yeah.
And it's like, hey, I'm going to go ahead and trigger your psychosis again.
And it births into cinema, the cinema world, Hannibal Lecter, one of the greatest characters ever. I mean,
exactly.
He's up there with Darth Vader, as a ultimate bad guy. All around great, great stuff from Michael Mann on a budget. Now obviously he paints with the biggest palette on earth, well-deserved, even on a shoestring. He does great stuff.
Yeah, speaking of shoestring, I did not know this, but doing the research for the show, apparently Michael Mann never got clearance to shoot on an airplane.
I love this story.
So he just booked everybody in the crew tickets on the plane.
And checked the camera as luggage. So they just pulled it all out and started filming. And when the passengers complained, they mollified them with crew jackets. Here you go. We're making a movie. Here. It was just, what do you need? A small? Here you go.
Yeah, it was the late 80s, right?
It's so amazing that actually happened.
And then, you know, the use of Enigata DeVita, one of the greatest needle drops ever.
Yeah, it was great. It was perfect. I can hear Tarantino, Wes Anderson, you know, as like teenagers or, you know, 20-year-olds going, dude, I got like whatever that guy's doing, I got to do that.
Well, I think we got it. What do you guys think? Anything more to say?
Well, I have to say, if you haven't seen Manhunter, you should probably go watch it.
Well, don't listen to us, man. Good. Stop what you're doing. Yeah. Like, we just ruined it for you. But
well, we didn't.
It really is something to see. If you're a Michael Mann fan, it is the connective tissue between Miami Vice, Thief, Heat, and pretty much his whole oeuvre of like troubled men with, you know, on a mission.
And if you're currently in film school looking for a thesis topic, somebody try to connect the dots between Dracula and Manhunter, because I would love to read that paper.
Yeah. Just so you know, you have inside information that Coppola, the one thing Coppola checked out, the movie he checked out the most was Manhunter, right? Is that what you're saying?
True. Yeah. It was funny. Because I remember one of the other films I took home was Yankee Doodle Dandy, like next week. Right. And because I was like just trying to mimic whatever Coppola was saying. Yeah. And I watched that film and I was like, why the fuck am I watching this? And you know what? You know why? Because this is a great piece of entertainment. And then, you know what? I think probably Francis just wanted to, you know, kick back with a bottle of red and just be like, you know, who doesn't love Spencer Tracy dancing, playing Cohan?
James Cagney.
Thank you. Yeah. And Black and White, you know. And anyways, that's the other film I remember being introduced to in that library that still sticks in my mind.
He should have released a list of all that stuff. It would be great to see that. Like, what were his big check? What was his blockbuster video lineup?
If only mobile phones were invented, cell phones, I would take a picture of it. Well, I will never know.
We'll never know.
Maybe we will. I don't know.
Anyway, thank you so much.
Yeah, Evan.
Thanks, man. Long time coming.
Of course. My pleasure.
So good.
One of our favorite films, Manhunter. And of course, go check out all of Evan's films, Cabin Fever 1 through, what is it, 79?
79.
78.
And of course, Zombievers, Fanboys, and many others.
I do have to ask, there's no needle drop on Cabin Fever news right now, is there, Evan? Is there anything coming? Is there any updates on what might be in the future for Cabin Fever for all the listeners out there? Can we break any? Can we break any news?
That's what I can talk about.
Oh, mystery! It's a mystery. Right?
There's something
is a mystery.
That's all I could say.
You heard it here first on How I Got Greenlit.
There's a mystery. I will say this. I will say this. You are so sly.
And with that. This has been How I Got Greenlit. I'm Ryan Gibson.
I'm Alex Collegian. And check us out on social, on Twitter and Instagram at How I Got Greenlit. Also, if you want to email us, howigotgreenlit@gmail.com. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks. Thanks for joining us.